Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll also uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of the dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So, Abby, you might have heard about this, but a couple of days ago, I think on Friday or Saturday, Ella Delon passed.
I saw.
It was all over the news here because French cinema and like European cinema is like a big thing. And it really got me thinking because I all of a sudden saw all the people posting about him. And I know that like us talking about him in this podcast, we didn't paint him in the best picture because I feel like this part of his life, really, he wasn't playing a good role. I'm sorry, but what he did was kind of shitty.
He didn't present himself well.
No, but like that doesn't mean obviously that he's a horrible person. It just meant that like this part of his life maybe wasn't the best. He didn't make the best decisions there. But it all brought me back to this one picture that I saw ages ago of Ella Delon, Marianne Faithfull, and Mick Jagger.
I had no idea that was him in the photo.
It is one of my favorite pictures.
I didn't know he was in so much either. Like, I just kept seeing more posts and more posts. And I'm like, he was in this movie? He was in that movie?
Look, it's incredible. He's like a French James Bond kind of guy. He was everywhere. But that one picture, I love it so much because it like it encapsulates Mick and Marianne. And for those of you who don't know, basically there's a picture, you have to imagine there's a couch, and in the middle there's Marianne Faithfull, and she's like kind of tilted to the side talking to Ella Delon, who's wearing like a very classic suit, and he's just like smiling kind of cheekily.
Yeah, Marianne has this beautiful dress with all these ostrich feathers.
They look fabulous. And then next to them is Mick Jagger, and he's like sitting with his legs crossed and like kind of sunken into himself. He looks like a little boy. He's wearing like pink pants, and he's obviously quite pissed that his girlfriend is talking to this very attractive man. But I thought it was just so fun, and it kind of, after the last episode, the Nico episode, the last time that I thought about Ella Delon, I didn't really have the best feeling about him. But then I saw this picture and I was like, man, we all make mistakes at one point. It's all good. Rest in peace, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What happened with you? I heard there was a fridge thing going on.
Oh, Emma, that's not even the beginning of it.
Oh, boy.
If you see this on camera, the people listening will not be able to see this, but
your arm! It is smacked.
I got bit twice by something I'm very allergic to. This is the first time in my life I've ever had an allergic reaction like this. I show my dad, he immediately gives me Benadryl. Like, the first time he saw me after this, because it was swollen and awful. This is what it looks like a week later, and it's still going away.
You don't see this, but there's, like, on Abby's arm, there's as big as a hand, basically, like a red patch.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and all of that was so swollen. Not fun. That was not a fun day. And then, a few days ago, I thought my fridge was dying. I'd just gotten groceries, too, because that's always how it goes. But I open up the fridge after I made my dinner, and I go, freezers are not supposed to be 35 degrees. Oh, the fridge part is 60. I'm shutting the door now and calling my dad.
Oh, no.
So he plugs in his freezer downstairs just in case. I text my mom, and my mom doesn't really know what to do about this either. I'm just alone with this potentially dying fridge.
Oh, no.
This is fine. So I just had my dad, like, turn everything on the maximum setting, and I didn't open the fridge for the rest of the night. In the morning, it was miraculously fine.
Oh. Oh. Why do things like that always happen in the summer too? It's like always the same. Mm-hmm.
I immediately thought of as soon as the weather warmed up for you when your radiator fell off the wall. That was the first thing I thought of.
But that was a good timing.
Yes, and this...
But here's the catch. They still haven't fixed it. We're still waiting. So I'm just hoping because I'm like... I mean, we still have like a lot of hot days. But I'd say mid-September going into October is usually the time where you want to start turning up the heating at least a little bit.
Yeah, in about a month. And then we have another lovely little incident on Monday. I was cleaning up here and I wanted to dust my perfume tray because I have a lot of things there. I collect not just records, I collect everything. It's a little bit out of control.
I'm the same.
I'm a sentimental pack rat. So I move all of that perfume tray stuff just onto my bed so I can dust the flat surface. Over there, I have this prayer candle. It is bright red. And I just laid it on its side for not more than a minute to dust. I pick it up and there's this big splotch of red candle wax on my beautiful bedding. The sun hit it just right. It warmed up the glass and it only took about 1 or 2 minutes. So again,
were you able to get it off?
Most of the way. I'm frantically Googling how to get, you know, saturated bright red candle wax out of fabric.
Oh no.
I just soaked up as much as I could with a paper towel, ran it through the wash twice, and now this spot is still there if you squint at it.
Maybe over time it'll fade more.
I was due for some new bedding anyway.
Oh boy, that's always how it goes.
And that's what you missed on Glee.
Yeah, talking about Glee, this is such a weird... I've seen people talk about Glee a lot lately. I don't know what it is. I always see, like, I open YouTube and people are like, Glee is the most awkward show. And I watched as, like, a teenager. Probably when, I don't know, when it aired. 2012 or something?
I watched it at that time, too. Yeah.
I mean... And I didn't thought it was that weird. And then the other day, I like clicked on this one video and that guy was like, the entire storyline of Mr. Schuster is so messed up. And I was like, it really is? How did I not see this? Oh boy.
That would be a fun rewatch sometime.
Oh yeah.
I think I made my college roommate watch the first season of Glee with me because she had never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a trip for her. I have fantastic video clips of us from that apartment just doing college girl apartment things. And you can hear the Glee music in the background, the little a cappella stuff. Perfect soundtrack.
Oh,
highly
yeah.
recommend.
Oh, man. I didn't make it through the entire series. I dropped out in like season 3 or 4, something like that. I don't even know how many seasons there are. But then like I remember... I watched it and then I stopped and then a couple years later I turned on the TV and it was just on and there were like a whole different cast. And I was like, oh, I must have missed a whole bit here.
I think they made it 5 or 6 seasons. Things got weird when they graduated and went to New York.
Oh, yeah.
And then it didn't really make sense anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't watch it that far. But I really, like, back then I really liked the first couple of seasons. Now I'm like, that's an awkward show.
They didn't age very well.
But I'm happy that we started this episode on such a light note because, once again, this episode is a little more on the sad side. But I truly wanted to make this episode.
I know how excited you are for it.
Oh, I really am. She's so special to me.
This is our second episode on a Warhol superstar now. You seem to have a soft spot for them.
I really do. I don't know, something about the entire scene is very fascinating for me, but I feel like this is a particularly interesting episode because it intersects with a lot of other people we've already talked about a couple of times. So today's episode is about a woman I've always been deeply fascinated by, mostly because after all, she always appeared to be the picture of what others wanted to see. She always seemed to be looking for a family, for someone who appreciated and loved her the way she was. From her isolated childhood on a ranch to her party-filled days in New York, today's episode is all about Edie Sedgwick. This episode mainly comes from 3 books I've read. The first one is, as it turns out, Thinking About Edie and Andy by Edie's older sister, Alice Sedgwick Wohl. There's actually an audiobook too. After I read the book, I discovered that, and then I listened to a bit of the audiobook, because sometimes I feel like when you hear the voice, it is her reading it herself. So I really wanted to listen to certain parts to kind of like hear the way that she would say things, if that makes sense. I feel like sometimes the pronunciation really does make a difference. So that was really interesting and a great insight, especially on their childhood. I would say the first bit of the book isn't really that much about Edie, but it is about the family and the dynamics. And I feel like that's something really good to know if you want to understand Edie. The next book is called Girl on Fire by David Wiseman. And then there's Edie, an American Girl by Jean Stein and George Plimpton. I feel like that is the most popular one. But I just want to take a moment to thank all these authors for their amazing work and recommend you these books if you want to get a little deeper into Edie's life. So usually in our episodes, we start with the parents' generation. But in this case, I think it is important to start a little earlier. Edie comes from a very prestigious and influential family. The Sedgwick family records can be traced back into the 10th century, and her ancestors were among the group of men who declared the independence of America. Unlike portrayed in the movie Factory Girl, the Sedgwicks didn't sign it, but it is true they could have because they were there. And there's one more thing about the Sedgwicks, something that was definitely more of a family secret. Many of the family members struggled with mental health issues. These struggles can be traced back in Edie's family for generations. And unfortunately, a big part of her life was shaped by her and her family members' mental health struggles.
It is. When you told me that the Sedgwicks can trace their lineage back to the 10th century, I was surprised because that is a very long time, but also not because prominent really rich white American families, that tracing your lineage back and taking pride in that is such a thing. People meticulously keep their family records because they have the money to do that. They have family crests and display them in their home, not unlike English nobility. It's very much a thing, especially in old school New England.
That's interesting.
The Sedgwicks were politically involved and academically inclined, with all attending Harvard. Harvard is very much a legacy school, so this didn't surprise me either. They all had impressive careers, too. Edie's father, Francis, struggled to live up to the Sedgwick name throughout his life. He was the runt of the family, often sick as a child. Unfortunately, his mother took out a lot of her frustrations on him. Over time, she lost her sight and her mind began to deteriorate. When Francis's brother passed away at just 17, it was her breaking point. She simply couldn't handle it and died shortly after. This triggered Francis's first nervous breakdown. After recovering, he followed the Sedgwick tradition and went to Harvard. They were known for their athleticism at Harvard, but Francis didn't quite have the same physical strength as his ancestors. This was a huge source of embarrassment for him. Back then, a man failing to meet these expectations was a major blow to the ego. It weighed heavily on him. After finishing school, Francis went into banking and finance and spent some time living in London. However, something happened there that led to another breakdown. Needing a place to recover, he reached out to an old friend, Charles DeForest. His family had a place in the English countryside. While there, Francis fell in love with Charles's younger sister, Alice. The family initially didn't want her to marry Francis because of his mental health struggles, but she was determined. So on May 9th, 1929, they got married. But before the wedding, Francis had to stay in the hospital again, where he confided in the doctors that he was about to get married. These two were a truly beautiful couple. This is something that comes up over and over again. As far as looks go, the Sedgwicks were genetically blessed.
Oh, they truly were. There are a lot of pictures in these books, especially the one that Edie's sister wrote. And you just look at them and they could all be film stars. They're just really, really attractive people. Initially, his doctors advised Francis against having children. They basically told him that with his family's mental health record, the chances of his kids inheriting the struggles was really, really high. But Francis wasn't one to follow the rules, so Alice and him started having a baby almost every other year from 1929 to 1945.
That is a huge age range with all those kids. You have the oldest that are almost 20 years older than the youngest.
Yeah, it's interesting because the oldest one is Alice, who wrote the book, and then Edie was the second youngest. Mm. Another thing about the Sedgwick kids, we'll get to this, is but they were shipped off to boarding schools pretty early on. Mm-hmm. So most of her childhood, Edie only spent with her younger sister, Suki, because everyone else was pretty much already out. Mm. They first had Alice, which they'd call Saucy. Then there's Robert, nicknamed Bobby, Pamela, Mimi, Francis, Minty, Jonathan, who for some reason didn't have a nickname, Catherine, Kate, then came Edith, Edie, and finally Susanna, Suki. Francis loved pet names, and the children's weren't ever called by their actual names.
That's another rich person thing.
I think so, too.
If you're, say, for instance, John, you are, or Jonathan, you are rarely John. You could be JJ, you could be Jack. If you're a junior, you could be Chip, like Chip off the old block. If you're the third, your nickname might be Trip.
That is interesting, but I read that like a lot of the names that these children have, and that is, I think, also something that comes with this old money family lifestyle, were names of their grandmas, their like aunts, the names just come back. I mean, there's one son called Francis, so that's just kind of how it went. But that wasn't all of it. Francis also didn't want his kids to call him Dad. Instead, they were to refer to him as Fuzzy. Since Alice does this in her book and Edie does it too, we'll just call him Fuzzy from here on. So the Sedgwick children became a sort of badge of honor for their father. He had more kids than any of his Harvard classmates, and he made sure everyone knew about it. It seemed like this was his way of saying, I may not be athletic, but look at me, I'm a real man because of all these children I fathered. Fuzzy went back to Harvard for business school, but soon realized that a regular career just wasn't in the cards for him. Fortunately, Alice, his wife, had a fortune, so they lived off of her money for many years. But it didn't sit well with Fuzzy. He didn't like the idea of relying on her wealth. Doctors encouraged him to explore his artistic side, and he eventually became a successful sculptor. Still, the shame of not living up to the Sedgwick legacy haunted him into adulthood. Fuzzy became obsessed with appearances. The Sedgwicks were known for being incredibly good-looking, and Fuzzy was no exception. He exercised daily, driven by his need to be the perfect picture of health, strength, and fertility. The family lived on Long Island before moving to Santa Barbara, where the last few kids, including Edie, were born. They had a massive ranch, and when they discovered oil on the property, Fuzzy finally had his own money, which helped him shake off some of the guilt he felt about living off of Alice. But let's be real, he didn't really earn that money. He really just got lucky. After striking oil, they moved to an even bigger ranch in Santa Barbara. This place was enormous, stretching as far as the eye could see. It sounded like a fairy tale, with afternoons filled with tennis, horseback riding, and intellectual conversations at dinner. But in reality, it was far from idyllic.
The kids were more like props to Fuzzy. He would show them off at parties, like, look at all my kids, look at what I've done. But the Sedgwicks were mostly raised by nannies. Alice wasn't as harsh as Fuzzy, but she was from a time where wives didn't have much say in how the household was run. Edie's childhood was... interesting. Her siblings all said she was absolutely spoiled and tended to get her way. Mm. Saucy wrote in her book how she used to get spanked by Fuzzy after Alice told him something she'd done. Their lives had changed after moving to the ranch. The older Sedgwick children were raised in a very classic old money way. They had to learn their manners and appropriate ways to talk to their elders. Edie and Suki were the last two children, and their parents were a lot less strict with them. Edie was stubborn, and she'd wear people down. By 14 months old, most of the Sedgwick kids were already riding horses. Edie was no different. Her world revolved around that ranch. The kids were homeschooled and rarely left the property. Edie didn't have friends outside of her older siblings, but she was an adventurer at heart. She loved the outdoors and riding horses. By the time Edie was born, the Sedgwick family was already falling apart. Fuzzy was an adulterer, and as the years went on, his affairs became more blatant. He'd cheat not only in front of Alice, but also in front of their guests. She chose to ignore it, pretending to be sick and staying home to avoid confrontation. She became a recluse. Fuzzy even wrote a novel which, while he didn't say so, was clearly autobiographical. It was about a sculptor who married a wonderful and wealthy woman, then got bored and had an affair. Sound familiar? Alice was heartbroken, seeing a lot of herself in the wife in the book.
And it is so interesting because he didn't even told her that he was writing a book. Like, no one in the family knew, and then apparently one day he was like, look, I wrote a book, and people read it, and they were like, really? Like, the older kids obviously understood. They had understood this before, but like, adding this layer of writing this bizarre book is just so painful. And I can just imagine for Alice, I mean, she knew how he was. She knew that he was kind of like going around with other women, but seeing him write that down and being like, so talking about it? Yeah, and talking about being so passionately in love with another woman, that must have hurt so bad.
Mm-hmm. The kids saw all of this too, and by the time Edie was around 10, she was the only one who stood up to her father. Her brother Jonathan said, quote, I always thought Edie wanted to escape on her horse, but she couldn't leave the ranch. She was trapped. It usually started with a fight with our father. She always felt like he would come after her, so she could only run away on the ranch. She'd disappear into the mountains, and you'd never know where she was. Then she'd come back, all mellowed out.
This is a very important part of Edie's upbringing. Life on the ranch was very isolated, and she didn't know any children beside her sibling. They never watched TV or went to the cinema. So when she'd later star in films, she never really understood the appeal it had to others. Hmm. The Sedgwick family also sent their kids off to boarding school early on, which is where Edie would spend most of her childhood. Alice wrote that she'd always thought Edie's birthday was April 18th until a couple of years ago when she read the headline Happy Birthday, Edie Sedgwick, which was published on April 20th. So even within the family, most of the siblings felt really isolated and alone. We talked about this. Alice is a significantly amount older than Edie is, but something that comes up over and over again with this family is that they didn't talk about things. Things were just as they were, and you weren't supposed to ask any questions, and you weren't supposed to make anyone uncomfortable.
Again, old money thing. Sweep it under the rug.
Just like her siblings, Edie was sent to boarding school at 13, a place she intensely disliked. She was removed after a while, likely due to struggling with an eating disorder that included anorexia and bulimia. Her sister Alice recalled how Edie would eat an entire meal within a couple of minutes, then she'd excuse herself and go to the restroom. A couple of minutes later, she'd come back and eat another plate before going to the restroom again. She'd do this over and over again for a long time, and no one said anything. According to Alice, no one in this family ever talked about anything at all. After returning home, she discovered her father, Fuzzy, with another woman. In response, Fuzzy arranged for a doctor to come to their house, drug Edie to ensure her story would be disbelieved, and then sent her to an even more distant school. This is so wild. I don't want to say that for some people, drug abuse is in the cards, but I just want to say if this is the way that you are raised, maybe it isn't that far off for you to try pills.
You would be predisposed to that.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, Fuzzy was in and out of hospitals, doctors all his life. So I feel like she just grew up with a different relationships to pills and hospitals than most people. Despite these challenges, Edie managed to flourish at this new school, becoming class president and the most popular girl. However, her rebellious teenage phase meant she only stayed there for a year, although it seemed that Fuzzy favored Edie and allowed her more leeway than her siblings, this did not shield her from the difficulties she faced.
One night, Fuzzy crawled up into Saucy's bare shoulder, as she wore a sleeveless dress, and told her that he could understand how men felt about her. She mentioned this because when Edie went to New York, she told people that Fuzzy made sexual advances toward her from the age of 7. By that time, she no longer lived at home. Saucy goes on saying that Edie never spoke about it to her, and she wasn't there when it happened, so this could very well be true. When Edie was around 17, Fuzzy sent her to Silver Hill, a mental hospital where Minty had previously been treated. Minty, the most sensitive of the Sedgwick siblings, was subject to Fuzzy's harshest treatment. He seemed to see in Minty a reflection of his own artistic but non-athletic qualities, which he despised. Fuzzy imposed immense pressure on him to conform to his idea of manhood. It seems he was obsessed with this idea. Minty also struggled at Harvard. Though not exactly a country club, Silver Hill was relatively relaxed compared to other institutions, catering to wealthy patients. It did little to address Edie's eating disorder. Once they realized she had a strong will and wasn't compliant, they transferred her to Bloomingdale, a much stricter facility.
I found this really interesting because this is about 10 years, almost 15 years prior to Karen Carpenter and her struggles. And I think it is really interesting to see these two families dealing with it, because while the Sedgwicks, just like the Carpenters, wanted to put everything under the rug, they at least realized that she needed some sort of help. Mm-hmm. They really overdid it. You will hear it in the story over and over. They hospitalized her a lot and probably way too often. But I just want to say that generally, I feel like they had the right idea of trying to get her help. It's just with eating disorders, we've talked about it in the Karen episode, it is so hard to find a good treatment.
Yes.
At Bloomingdale, Edie was in this state of despair, feeling suicidal and starving herself because she didn't want to end up like her family. The facility provided more effective help than Silver Hill, and by the end of her stay, as she approached her 20s, Edie had more freedom. She was able to manage her eating disorder better and enjoyed more independence, including the ability to come and go as she pleased. It is reported that here Edie lost her virginity to a fellow patient and got pregnant. However, she had an abortion which she didn't get to decide whether she actually wanted to do it. Apparently, back then, when you were a psychiatric case, this was the way to, in quotes, handle the situation. Which is so heartbreaking. It comes up a little later in her life. There was this time where she was like hallucinating a lot, dreaming bad a lot. And she said that she had another abortion that she didn't want at another hospital later. But her sister said she's pretty sure that it was just the trauma of the first abortion that she never really got over. Because she was in and out of hospitals all her life, Edie didn't have much of an education. But her parents were able to get her into Cambridge to study sculpting. I bet the Sedgwick name just did a lot for them in this case too.
She was very talented from the photos I've seen.
She really was. It is interesting because her teacher said how incredibly talented and amazing she was, even though she barely showed up to classes. And when she did, she was usually with a bunch of friends that she had been partying the night before. Her sister said she really only saw one sculpture that she made, which was kind of like a surrealistic horse. But yeah, Edie also didn't go through with this. So in the fall of 1963, 20-year-old Edie began studying art at Cambridge. Like her father, she had been drawing and sculpting since childhood, and her work was impressive. You can find some of Edie's artwork online or in various books. We actually posted a picture that she drew with the post that we always do where we try...
The hint post.
Yeah, the hint post where we...
And there's a photo of her sculpting in the studio as well, right?
Truly beautiful, and... It is so interesting because some people recognized her, but a lot of people didn't. I feel like a lot of people think that she'd always had this like light colored hair, but she actually did have natural, really dark hair, almost black, and like these very dark eyes. She looks like a completely different person in these like pictures. At Cambridge, Edie was adored by those around her, and she was constantly the center of attention from many admirers. Even though she had practically no experience with peers her age, she was charming and outgoing. She didn't stick to one group of friends, but instead floated among different social circles, embracing the new social freedom she finally had. Looking back, it's clear how isolating her time on the ranch must have been. being cut off from social interaction and confined to a controlled environment would have been incredibly stifling. Fuzzy's need for control over every aspect of their lives contributed to this oppressive atmosphere. So in Cambridge, Edie felt free and always looked forward to the night when she could go out and party.
Suki noted Edie's tendency to move between different social groups. It might have been a form of self-preservation. She seemed to avoid forming deep relationships, possibly due to her past experiences. She dated, but often her partners fell hard for her, while she remained emotionally unavailable. While at Cambridge, Edie spent a lot of nights out, often with different men. Suki tried to have her committed for what she saw as bad behavior, however, Edie managed to avoid it. At Cambridge, she befriended a group of glamorous, sophisticated gay men from the Harvard scene. They gave her the attention she craved without any threat of romantic or physical involvement. They spoke highly of her, praising her beauty and her lively spirit. She was always the life of the party. Everyone wanted to be near her. She was a magnetic presence. Her friend, John Anthony Walker, captured her essence with this quote. She was a catalyst. By being in contact with her, the edges were sharper, and evening with Edie would only end when she had reached the point of exhaustion, after 2 or 3 days. It's that old yogi axiom, the higher you go, the further you fall. We all know that she liked being very close to extinction, always. Edie was living life to the fullest, like a ball of fire for the very first time. Meanwhile, Minty and Bobby were frequently in and out of hospitals, suffering from Fuzzy's abuse. He was harsh with Bobby, constantly belittling him, calling him stupid, and telling him he had nothing but his looks. With Minty, Fuzzy's cruelty came from dismissing his sensitivity and pressuring him to conform to traditional ideas of manhood.
While Edie was at Cambridge, Minty took his own life just a day before his 26th birthday. This tragic event came shortly after Minty confessed to Fuzzy that he was in love with another man. Yeah, this is so hard. Edie was devastated by Minty's death. She knew about Minty's struggle and how Fuzzy had reacted, leading her to blame her father for Minty's suicide. She fell into a deep period of grief and began feeling the need for change, sensing that she needed to leave the Cambridge world behind. This part of Alice's story really broke my heart. She recalled how she got a phone call and answered it with her 6-week-old baby next to her. On the other end was Fuzzy telling her, in quotes, "Minty hung himself. No hello, no introduction." It is so hard, and apparently by the end of his life, Fuzzy felt really bad for a lot of the things he did, but I wonder whether he ever felt bad about the initial decision to have children, because his doctor said he shouldn't do it because they would have such bad mental health struggles, and that's pretty much exactly what happened.
Hearing and reading these accounts, I just get to thinking that in that family, nobody ever stood a chance, no. Especially not Edie. She was just given none of the tools to succeed on her own.
Yeah.
It seems none of the children were.
They grew up in such a fantasy world, so far off from anything that was sort of normal, that they really didn't stand a chance. The only thing that was really good about the family life was the fact that the Sedgwicks really cared about the education for their children. Mm-hmm. All these kids went to really good schools. Alice actually became an art historian and like a really good one. I want to say a lot of publications. She like works a lot. So I thought that that was really interesting, but I feel like Fuzzy was so unhappy with his own life. And he constantly took it out on everyone else. Edie was constantly haunted by the fear of Fuzzy's control, always worried that if she stepped out of line, he might come after her again or lock her up. This fear was ever present in her mind. As Edie turned 21, she decided it was time to explore the world beyond her previous confines and set her sights on New York. She moved to Manhattan with aspirations of becoming a model. Fortunately, she inherited $80,000. That is about $820,000 in today's money.
Wow.
That is wild. This money came from her maternal grandmother and provided her with a financial cushion. Edie lived with her grandma in New York until she had enough of Edie's party lifestyle. Her friend Danny Fields offered her to stay, he thought only for the weekend, but Edie made herself right at home, staying for a couple of weeks before she eventually found her own place. In New York, Edie quickly found herself surrounded by a network of friends, including Chuck Wine, who was a major presence in her life. The city was abuzz with excitement as Edie dove into the vibrant social scene, attended dance classes, and used her inheritance to indulge in her desires, including clothes and hair treatments. The early photos of her capture a stunning beauty with long brown hair and dark eyes, embodying a captivating dark allure. Edie became an instant sensation in the city's coolest spot, frequented places like La Ventura and Undine. By December of 1964, her reputation had reached Bob Dylan and Bob Newworth, who were eager to meet her. Dylan reached out, and the three of them spent a memorable evening at the Kettle of Fish in Greenwich Village. Newworth recalled, in quotes, "Edie was fantastic. She was always fantastic. We spent an hour or two laughing and having a terrific time. She had the ability to relate on all levels, from chauffeurs to ranch hands, understanding the human condition, yet at the same time, because of her upbringing, rejected anything less than the best."
Edie's wealth and isolated background were evident. She would rent limousines to travel around the city, evident of her $80,000 inheritance. Basically, she was completely out of touch. Dylan, who appreciated people with compelling stories, was drawn to Edie's unique background and eccentric personality. Edie, newly independent and reveling in her freedom, quickly found herself spending money extravagantly. With no real financial skills, she racked up bills without paying them off and lived on credit. Her generosity was boundless. She would often treat entire parties, including the strangers, to lavish dinners and always picked up the tab at the bar. I bet they were buying top-shelf alcohol, too.
Oh, yeah.
Within just 6 months, she burned through her entire inheritance.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, but it was no issue. She could just live off her parents.
I feel like that's also really interesting because the fact that she never really made enough money to sustain herself always put her in this role with her parents. Mm-hmm. She always needed them to rely on.
She wasn't making money herself, but loved to spend it on fashionable clothes, trendy restaurants, and nightclubs. Fuzzy was not pleased with this reckless spending, though he allowed it to happen anyway. He demanded Edie return home for Christmas. On New Year's Eve, the Sedgwicks got word that Bobby was involved in a motorcycle accident. Alice visited him in the hospital, where he was in a coma, and had to take him off life support. Fuzzy didn't give Bobby a proper funeral. Suki said, quote, "I don't know where my brothers are buried," meaning Bobby and Minty. "I don't think they're buried anywhere." Jonathan later revealed that Fuzzy had scattered their ashes on the ranch. In a grim twist, when Bobby passed, Edie was out in California driving her father's car when she ran a red light and crashed. She broke her leg and cut her forehead. Terrified her father would use the accident as an excuse to commit her again, Edie left the hospital with Alice's help and flew back to New York the very same night. Edie took Bobby's death very hard, believing he deliberately crashed his motorcycle to end his life. To cope, she threw herself back into the party scene, despite her broken leg. Bob Newworth recalled an incident at Harlow's where Edie had a sculptor chisel off her cast and used coat hangers tied together with neckties as a splint so she could dance. Her doctor warned her she may become permanently disabled, but Edie was determined to defy that. Her unique and captivating dance style became a fixture of the nightlife. She had a distinctive way of moving, with angular, almost Egyptian drawing-like movements. Think, like, Ian Curtis from Joy Division doing a Fosse routine.
Yeah.
She certainly stood out on the dance floor. She also accentuated her forehead scar with her eyeliner, making it a deliberate feature rather than a flaw.
I thought that that was so interesting because on some pictures you can clearly see that she had like a smudge on her forehead. And I always wondered whether it was like a makeup smudge or something, but it was really intentional. Also, if you want to see Edie dancing, you can type that into YouTube. There are a lot of videos. I would definitely recommend you to do it. It is captivating. Chuck Wine, a friend from Cambridge, played a crucial role in Edie's New York life. He saw her potential and took charge of her social calendar, introducing her to influential people. One of these connections was Lester Persky, a producer who saw Edie's star quality and arranged for her to meet Andy Warhol. Andy, who had previously had the spotlight on Baby Jane Holzer, was looking for a new muse. Edie made an immediate impression. She and Andy quickly became inseparable. Edie even chopped off her hair and spray-painted it silver, partly as an homage to Andy's silver wigs, creating a striking visual link between them. Truman Capote observed that Edie was like a version of Andy Warhol that he might have wished to be, a charming, well-bred debutante from Boston. Edie did the same screen test that we briefly talked about in the Nico episode. A camera was rolling while she just looks into it. You can find this on YouTube and it is truly captivating. It's easy to see what Andy saw in her. With Edie now a prominent figure in Andy Warhol's world, she became a fixture at gallery events and parties. Andy used Edie as a sort of mouthpiece in interviews, allowing her to shine and speak for both of them. Edie's charismatic personality and articulate nature made her a captivating presence in the media. The factory where Edie had arrived was a hive of eccentricity. Gerard Malanga, Andy's right-hand man, was well known in the art scene. Bridget and Richie Berlin, two contrasting sisters, were also part of this circle. Bridget was notorious for her rebellious spirit and disregard for social norms. Nico and Lou Reed, along with the Velvet Underground, were also emerging during this vibrant period.
The factory scene was indeed a world of its own, with a vibrant mix of artists, musicians, and eccentrics. Drugs were a major part of the atmosphere, with speed particularly popular among the crowd. Speed and heroin were widely used, but not understood as we do now. Warhol himself wasn't involved in drug use, preferring to maintain a more controlled presence at his studio. He put up a sign asking people not to do drugs at the factory. It was largely ignored. Edie, having been introduced to drugs at a young age, naturally fit into this culture. Edie played prominent roles in several of Warhol's films, Beauty No. 2, Space, and most notably, Poor Little Rich Girl. Through these films, you can see her artistic evolution. Chuck Wine, crucial to Edie's career, often took the lead in directing her. Chuck understood that Edie thrived when she was simply being herself. His skill was capturing that. You could call Edie the original manic pixie dream girl. Warhol, known for his minimalist approach, didn't really direct much, very hands-off guy. Instead, he let collaborators like Chuck shape the content of his films. It was the same with recording VU and Nico. Yeah. He just let the Velvets do whatever the hell they wanted in the studio, and he was like, oh yeah, that's great.
I think Andy's key talent was to bring together the right people. I really believe so. He was in his factory and he created this hub where just these amazing people could meet and link up for these projects. And I think he was a great artist too, but I feel like a lot of his work was just bringing together the right people at the right time.
I don't think this was in the script, Emma, but isn't Femme Fatale about Edie?
It is really interesting. We talked about this in the Nico episode, I think. Andy wanted them to write a song about Edie.
Yes.
And then Lou came up with the Femme Fatale thing.
By March of 1965, Edie's popularity was growing rapidly. With the hype surrounding her and Warhol's collaborations, Edie's name was becoming widely recognized. Their friendship was very codependent. Initially, Fuzzy was somewhat pleased with it. But as it became clear what kind of world she was involved in, one that didn't align with his expectations, he disapproved. Edie's financial situation was still precarious. Despite her fame, she continued relying on her parents for financial support. This created constant tension in her life, as you said, Emma, exacerbated by her fear of her father's control. Edie herself said that her parents had closed down her credit and were attempting to confine her again. The threat of being locked up loomed over her, especially when her psychiatrist told her parents about her drug use.
I truly wonder whether Fuzzy and Alice thought that they were doing her a favor by always locking her up, or whether it was some sort of punishment.
I think it was both.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it was punishment, Sometimes it was preventative, and sometimes they just didn't know what else to do.
Yeah. But they really got their children so dependent on psychiatrics and, like, different mental hospitals. It is wild. In an attempt to escape this pressure, Edie, along with Chuck and Andy, went to Europe. They traveled to Paris, Madrid, and London, where they promoted Poor Little Rich Girl and met various influential figures. During this time, Edie continued to garner attention, even catching the interest of notable people such as Bob Dylan and attending a Kennedy compound party. Despite this whirlwind of fame and social events, Edie was still haunted by her fear of her father's retribution. A noteworthy moment occurred when Edie's father, Fuzzy, met Andy Warhol in New York. The encounter, though much dramatized in fictional accounts, was reportedly polite but not deeply engaging. Fuzzy had initially been anxious about Warhol due to rumors of a sexual relationship between him and Edie, but his attitude shifted when he realized that Warhol's public persona was less threatening than he had imagined. I often read that Edie saw a father figure in Andy. After all, Andy was 15 years her senior, and she looked up to him in many ways. And I feel like when you come from a father who disapproves of everything, you're just looking for someone who will appreciate you for something.
When you're surrounded by no, you look for people. You seek people who will tell you yes.
Oh yeah.
Even if they shouldn't.
So let's talk about another 60s figure who is as much myth as he is history. The legendary Dr. Robert. Yes, the Dr. Robert from the Beatles song. The factory scene of the 1960s was a vibrant yet ruthless world, and Dr. Robert, known for his controversial practices, was at the center of all of this. I just want to say here, he was a real doctor. He prescribed everything that he did prescribe because it was just simply legal back then. Mm-hmm. His clinic was a playground for New York's artistic and social elite, where he administered a potent mix of speed, cocaine, and LSD. They would just drop by him and he'd give them so-called shots. For many, including Edie, these shots weren't just part of their routine. They were the key to maintaining their high-octane lifestyles. The highest dose cost about $25, and those who made it up to this dose often came in several times a day. Edie's parents, perhaps oblivious to the full extent of what was going on, even accompanied her to these sessions, trusting that a doctor's care was safe.
Oh.
Yeah, it's wild. Looking back at this, it is absolutely wild, but I actually read that Dr. Robert never got his medical license revoked because he always did what was legal. This was back when all these things were still legal. It is so wild.
Oh.
And he would mix speed, cocaine, and LSD with vitamins, which I found so weird because he thought that would, like, make a really healthy mixture for you.
Oh, boy. I'm just gonna give my patients a healthy version of cocaine. What could possibly go wrong?
Fuzzy, who wasn't a stranger to doctors and precipitants, reportedly thought that these shots were mainly vitamin. Dr. Robert's treatments were both a status symbol and a mean to fuel the relentless energy of the factory crowd. And Edie was one of his regulars. But the drugs, while they helped her maintain her public persona, also contributed to her rapid decline. The highs they provided were a temporary escape from her emotional turmoil, but they also sped up her downfall. It seemed like all her life, Edie was chasing happiness. She was always looking for the next high, the next kick, something to make her feel better. I actually also read that Dr. Robert was on several payrolls of Andy Warhol's films. Mm. He would just be there and, like, administer these shots all day long.
Just on set?
Yes. He would just come in, bring, like, his bag of stuff and go. Which I thought was really interesting after reading that Andy tried to put up a sign that no drugs were allowed in the factory, but I really feel that what he did wasn't seen as taking drugs. They probably really thought that this was healthy to at least some extent.
When you're that deluded, right?
Yeah.
By mid-1965, Edie was everywhere. Vogue spreads, Life magazine features, and all the tabloids. But her personal relationship with Warhol began to fray. He had once seen her as the star of his creative universe, but his focus had begun to shift. By July, their collaborations dwindled and Edie felt sidelined. While Warhol's star was rising, she was being left behind. This is how most people saw it, at least Saucy had a different feeling. She wrote that Edie dropped Andy. According to her, she saw the films he'd made and felt like they made her look ridiculous. On top of that, Edie wanted to work with Bob Dylan, and Dylan was not crazy about Warhol. Just as quickly as they became inseparable, they fell apart. The factory, known for its cruel antics, took it to a new level with Ingrid's superstar. One night, while the factory was out on the scene, they met a girl they thought looked, quote, like an ugly Edie. So they dressed Ingrid like Edie and made her their new star. This cruel prank wasn't just a slap in the face, it was a reflection of how cutthroat and transient this world could be. Ingrid, who became part of the factory herself, was initially unaware of the joke at her expense. There isn't much known about her besides her eventual disappearance. One day in the 80s, Ingrid went out to get cigarettes and just never returned. Her mother filed a missing persons report, but nothing ever came of it. She was eventually declared legally dead. It's like she just fell off the face of the earth. You can actually find photos of Edie and Ingrid together at the factory. I wonder if Edie ever felt threatened by Ingrid, or if it just hurt to see herself replaced so easily. People were quite disposable at the factory.
I feel like that's kind of the cycle, as we talked about it earlier, when Edie came in, Andy already had a muse, and he, like, dropped her. Then he went to Edie, then he kind of, like, dropped her for Nico and the Velvet Underground.
And then he dropped Nico.
Yeah. It just was the same thing over and over again, but I looked at pictures of Ingrid. I feel like she does kind of look like Edie, but it was also probably the hair and the way that she was styled. Mm-hmm. But honestly, that story of her just going missing is so wild to me. I don't know what it is, but something about these cases where people just are never seen again is so insane to me.
It's like, I'm trying to think. The ISB, the percussionist, and she played at Woodstock with them, I believe. She just went for a hike one day. And never returned.
Never came back, yeah. I have no idea how this happens, but I know it isn't likely, but I hope she's just somewhere doing well.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of 1965, Edie and Andy's relationship had cooled significantly. She was no longer his constant companion or a prominent figure at the factory. Andy had shifted his focus to Nico and the Velvet Underground. Edie did date John Cale briefly and even performed on stage with the Velvet Underground in January of 1966, marking sort of the final hurrah with the Warhol group.
Like, during the exploding Plastic Inevitable stuff?
Yes.
Huh.
We talked about this too in the Nico episode, as this was Nico's inauguration into the factory scene, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it was Edie's goodbye. At this point, Bob Dylan and Bob Newirth became more influential in Edie's life. Newirth mentioned that Dylan showed interest in doing a film with Edie and even suggested that she sign with his manager Albert Grossman to advance her career. Although Edie never openly confirmed an affair with Dylan, it might have happened. Dylan was married to his first wife during this period, so he may have kept quiet out of respect for her. Paul Morrissey recounts a time when Edie was at the factory talking about working with Dylan. When Andy Warhol heard about Dylan's secret marriage, he told Edie, who was visibly upset and trembling. Whether Edie and Dylan had a deep relationship or just a fling, it was clear that she was affected by the news. Dylan's fascination with Edie is evident in his songwriting. Some believe that Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat and Like a Rolling Stones were inspired by her.
Just Like a Woman, too. And all three songs are, if you look at the lyrics, mean as hell.
Yeah, but like, I feel like a lot of Bob Dylan's songs are mean. I just keep going back to thinking how he said to Nico that he just thinks women don't have nice voices to sing. That's like such a messed up thing to say.
I don't know. Dylan blamed Warhol for getting Edie into drugs. According to Saucy, she, quote, came that way. She'd started taking prescriptions back at home. Through her years in and out of psychiatric wards, she became used to always being on some sort of medication. Contrary to what's portrayed in Factory Girl, where Dylan is depicted as Edie's great love, her true romantic connection was with Bob Newirth. The first film Edie made without Warhol was with him. Unfortunately, it's never been shown publicly, and it's unclear why. Bob passed 2 years ago, so chances are slim we'll ever get to see it. It's a shame. We'd love to see how someone who truly loved Edie portrayed her. By April 1966, Edie and Warhol had their major falling out, leading to their official split. She struggled to build a new career outside of Warhol's world. Despite her fame, her lavish lifestyle, and rampant drug use tarnished her public image. Even Vogue, which had initially supported her, distanced itself. This was because Warhol's films were so scandalous. But Edie, who rarely went to the cinema or watched TV growing up, didn't understand why anyone would think that. Her attempts to act were met with challenges. She auditioned for Norman Mailer's play Deer Park, but didn't get a part because her intense performance style was deemed unsustainable.
They basically said if she gives her all like this in every rehearsal and every show, she will not make it out of this play ever again.
You can't do that for 8 shows a week.
Yeah. It is interesting because it comes up over and over again that Edie had this wonderful presence. And I think you can see that in interviews. She really has something about her that makes you look at her. But her sister Saucy said that Edie was really bad at memorizing any lines. So basically, whenever she would try to portray someone else, that was really hard. The films where she's really good in are the films where she's just kind of being herself.
Mm-hmm.
To make matters worse, Edie's father cut her off financially. Without any support, Edie's financial situation deteriorated further. On October 17th of 1966, she accidentally set fire to her apartment. She mentioned that while she was lighting candles, the drapes caught fire. At the time, she was still heavily under the influence of drugs. Though she burned a bit of her arm, she was otherwise unharmed. After this incident, she moved into the infamous Chelsea Hotel, a place she genuinely loved. Like many other artists who passed through, she found it to be a magical place. In November of 1966, Edie participated in one last film with Andy Warhol, titled The Andy Warhol Story. This film has never been publicly shown. René Ricard played Andy Warhol in the film, and it was René who insisted that Andy invite Edie. Andy agreed, promising to cover her taxi fare. Edie, likely desperate, accepted the offer. The filming turned out to be a harrowing experience. René played Warhol as he treated those beneath him, while Edie portrayed herself based on her feelings towards him. The dialogue between them was brutal, and both René and Edie found the experience nightmarish. Paul Morrissey, who was directing, became enraged and decided to stop the filming. Andy, however, perversely suggested continuing with another take, which escalated into violence. Edie started by crushing orchids René gave her, leading to a confrontation where Edie expressed her disdain for beauty and the role she was playing. After doing this scene twice, Edie fled the scene. Later, Andy invited them to view the rushes at the factory, where they discovered the footage had been edited heavily. Edie's voice was loud and clear, while they panned Renee's voice down. This made Edie seem insane and irrational.
Oh, man. Edie was struggling financially with mounting bills and no income. Albert Grossman hired a money manager for Edie to help her get her finances in order. He worked to negotiate with creditors and sought assistance from her family. Despite his efforts, Edie found herself asking friends for financial help. The contrast between her former glamorous lifestyle and her current situation was stark.
Mm-hmm.
The fact she once covered expenses for everyone only made it more obvious. Alice, concerned for her daughter's well-being, persuaded her to return to the ranch for Christmas 1966. However, after just one day, her father began giving her Nembutal, a sedative. Edie went along with it to avoid confrontation. In the middle of the night, her father woke her up, claiming she had a fever and needed to go to the hospital. Instead of an ambulance, there was a police car waiting. Fuzzy reported Edie to the police for suicidal ideation, leading to an involuntary commitment. Bob Newworth was frantically trying to reach her the whole time. When Fuzzy informed him of her commitment, Bob threatened him with legal action. He caved, and Edie was released a few days later. Unfortunately, soon after this, Edie and Bob broke up. He said they drifted apart due to her self-destructive behavior, which he attributed to desperation and a lack of constructive outlets for her energy.
I feel so bad for them because I feel like Bob truly loved her. He went out of his way to try and care for her. But I feel like Edie wasn't the person who you could save. I feel like even in the beginning of this story, you always have the feel that this isn't going to end well. There was something about her that made it seem like she never stood a chance.
She didn't have any of the tools to succeed.
Yeah. Edie reflected on their relationship in her film Chow Manhattan, describing it as a profound and passionate connection that ended tragically. She felt abandoned and lost after he left, leading her to turn increasingly to drugs. In early 1967, John Palmer and Robert Margalef decided to make a film about Edie, inspired by Chuck Wein's suggestion. This film included many of Edie's friends from the factory and featured a storyline about her life. Although the film itself wasn't highly regarded, it captured the essence of the scene.
During production, Edie accidentally set fire to her apartment at the Chelsea Hotel again. She fell asleep while holding a cigarette. She woke up still under the influence and couldn't unlock the door. In a panic, she hid in her closet, but the smoke seeped in and she burned her hand on the doorknob trying to escape. The cat Bob Dylan gave to her, which she named Smoke, died in the fire. Damage was so severe that Edie couldn't return to her apartment. There are very famous paparazzi photos of Edie with her hand bandaged up being carried out of the Chelsea by a firefighter. The Chelsea, understandably, evicted her. She then lived with one of Chow Manhattan's producers and had a 24/7 caretaker. This was to keep her safe and from engaging in any more reckless behavior. However, production faced numerous delays and financial losses due to her erratic behavior. In June, Edie decided to leave New York. She drove to Los Angeles with some friends.
Now, Abby, this next part is for you. Because next, Edie stayed at a place that you and I are particularly fascinated by, the castle in the Hollywood Hills. This was a popular residence for many notable figures, and this is where Edie and Nico crossed paths again. During her time there, Nico was staying there too, with one of our favorite 1960s guys, Jim Morrison.
Cross that off the bingo sheet.
He always comes up. While there, Edie even dated a few men, including Patrick Tilden, who was later known as a Warhol superstar. She also filmed Lulu with Bob Newworth and Richard Lee Clark. Edie's return to California was somewhat motivated by her father's deteriorating health. Fuzzy suffered from pancreatic cancer and eventually passed away in October, which deeply affected Edie and her family. Despite Fuzzy's troubled legacy, including infidelities and estrangements from Edie's mother, he made a final sculpture dedicated to his children before his death. Saucy wrote that Fuzzy felt a lot of guilt regarding his wife and children towards the end of his life, but he never reached out to anyone, so they truly don't know.
It was his pride.
Yeah, but I think it is interesting that this affected Edie so bad, because I felt like when this came up in the book, I had this feeling that this could go two ways. Either she felt really relieved or she was really sad. But I think after all, what made her so sad was that she never reached a point where Fuzzy accepted her.
Edie's struggles worsened when she returned to New York. This just wasn't a good environment for her, it sounds like. She began using speed again. She was committed to various psychiatric hospitals, spending about a year in these institutions, but this time she was subject to electric shock therapy. This was very traumatic for her and only exacerbated her condition. Eventually, Alice collected her and once again brought her back to the ranch. Upon returning, Edie faced severe physical and psychological challenges. She was in such bad shape that she couldn't move her arms or legs or even speak. It seems she had been heavily sedated, possibly restrained. She worked hard to regain her motor skills and eventually got her own apartment in Santa Barbara, showing remarkable resilience in the face of her ordeal. Jonathan made some troubling claims, suggesting Edie came onto him at the ranch. Edie said it was the other way around. The whole Sedgwick family was deeply troubled, so it's hard to know what really happened. When Edie arrived in California, she tried to build a new life for herself and make new friends, but drugs quickly came back into the picture. As a reminder for you listeners, she was around our age at this point, ours being Emma and I's age, 25, 26 years old. a lot happened to Edie in a very short frame of time. And honestly, no one would be remotely normal after a fraction of that.
No, you cannot go through this and just continue with your life like nothing happened. Jonathan also claims that Edie deliberately got herself arrested to stop her drug use. In the summer of 1968, he says she dropped her pills in front of a cop and kicked him hard, causing him to stumble. Edie was sent to Cottage Hospital, which was less strict than other places and allowed her some freedom. Despite this, she struggled with her need for attention and had a persistent desire for affection. She carried an old scrapbook around, showing it to patients and talking about her past, including her anger toward Andy Warhol. Edie's attempt to fit in with a biker gang after leaving the hospital shows her ongoing search for a sense of belonging. Even the bikers tried to help her stay clean, but it became too overwhelming for them. By the summer of 1970, she was back in the hospital. During this time, David Wiseman reached out to her about finishing the film Chow Manhattan. With permission from her doctors, Edie agreed to work on the film, but things were far from ideal. Before filming, Edie got breast implants, encouraged by a nurse. This is so messed up. You shouldn't do this to someone who's currently going through a mental health struggle.
Oh boy.
She proudly showed off her new body by appearing topless in much of the film, which felt particularly exploitative given her state. She was often impaired by drugs and alcohol, which made filming very difficult. Wiseman described the experience as exhausting and described Edie as resistant, fearing that once the film was done, she would be discarded.
After the film, Edie went back to the hospital for the first half of 1971, where she underwent more shock treatment. Amidst the turmoil, she found love with Michael Post. He was a former addict in treatment at the same time as her. They got engaged and were married on July 24th, 1971. They had a brief, happy summer together, during which Edie was clean. You can see in Edie and Mike's wedding photos that she looks so much healthier than she did in New York.
Yeah, and so much happier.
They're black and white photos, but she's got color back in her face. She just looked so gaunt at the factory.
Yeah, she's also back to her natural hair color. And just overall, it seems like a return back to herself and away from the Edie Sedgwick persona that she was kind of also playing while in New York.
She was on the precipice of finally having some sense of identity. But
yeah,
I did just say was. In the fall, Edie came down with an ear infection. She was allergic to her prescribed medication and needed to be put on something stronger. This unfortunately led to a relapse. On the night of November 15th, 1971, just 4 months into her marriage, Edie attended a fashion show. While there, she warned the other attendees she spoke with against using speed. However, she was subject to harsh words from a woman at the event, which left her feeling down.
There was basically this woman who, like, screamed at her for what she had done, was like, "You are telling us what to do after all that you fucked up." And I'm just like, how can someone treat another human being who obviously went through some sort of struggles like that? And especially a stranger. It is so wild to me that this happened. That night, Edie took some medication, went to bed, and tragically, when Michael woke up the next day, she had passed away. The cause of death was a combination of barbiturates and alcohol, which led to suffocation on her pillow. She was just 28 years old. I would like to end this episode with a quote from her sister Saucy reflecting on Edie. "Is it possible that she was not a superstar, not a real star after all, but more like a celestial body of another kind, composed by dark matter, knowable only by the gravitational pull that she extended?"
That gravitational pull quote reminded me of a song. There have been a few songs written for Edie after her death. Things just didn't stop at, you know, Femme Fatale and Just Like a Woman and the like. That quote reminded me of Velocity Girl, a B-side by a personal favorite group of mine, Primal Scream. Great tune. And Dream Academy wrote Girl in a Million for her. I love that title, Girl in a Million.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's the Edie Sedgwick I choose to remember. Velocity Girl and the Girl in a Million. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the incredible, impossible life of Edie Sedgwick.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. The button is somewhere around here. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.